more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of iRibe English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the religious and scholarly life of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite dignitaries, ulama and scholars all across the world of Islam during the history of Islam. For today's discussion, I have two very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sheikh Fadai. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Fadai, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alright, for today's discussion, we want to talk about another outstanding figure and faqih and mujtahid and mutakallim, Shiite one, of course, from India again. He is no one but Sayyid Ali Naqvi or Sayyid Dildar Ali Naqvi. Sheikh Rouhani, give us some details about this outstanding man from India, a Shiite one. Who was he exactly?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyid Dildar Ali Naqvi or Sayyid Ali Naqvi is a faqih, a jurist and theologian, a Shiite theologian from India, who was known in India as Ghufran Ma'ab.
Yes.
Of course, he studied in Najaf al-Ashraf and also in Mashhad, in the presence of the great scholars like Bahrul Ulum, Sahib Riyaz, Mirza Mahdi Shahristani. And of course, he had the permission of narrating riwayat of Ahlul Bayt from Sayyid Mahdi Khurasani and Mirza Mahdi Shahristani. So that's why he was among the mujtahid. At the beginning of his scholarly life, he was akhbari maslak, traditionist.
Yes.
But later he turned to usuli and, let's say, the principialist, we can say.
Yes.
And that's why he is among the founders of the school of usuli in India by the book titled as Asasul Usul.
Yes.
That's why he played a great role in campaigning against the Akhbariyun or traditionists in India. Yes, of course.
Yes. Okay.
Another point that could be mentioned about his scholarly life is that he is among the offspring of Imam Al-Hadi,
yes,
the 10th infallible Imam.
Thank you very much. So again, Sheikh Fadai, we have a figure that struggled very much in order to spread Shiite Islam in India, especially Usuli Maktab in India. Just talk a little bit for us about his scholarly life over there in India, especially in Lucknow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyid Ali Naqvi, as my brother mentioned, was born in India, but in order to use from great scholars of Shia Hoza, he had a journey to Iraq and could use from his great professors, Ayatollah Wahid Behbahani, Sahib Riyaz, Sayyid Bahrul Ulum, and Sayyid Muhammad Mahdi Khorasani after that in Iran. Imagine that he had two journeys to Iraq and Iran in order to use the knowledge of his professors. That is a very important point in his life that we can see this point even in other scholars' life, that they tolerate the hardship of journeys even at that time when the yes. journeys were not easy. They tolerated that in order to improve their knowledge, improve the science, and then transmit it to other people. And after being in the classes of his great scholars, he could have ijaza of rivaya. You know, at that time, before Usuli, the yes. school of thought, usually our scholars, mostly they were focused on rivaya.
Yes.
So, because Rivaya was the only source of deriving the rules of Islam from religion,
yes.
They were more sensitive about Rivaya.
Yes.
And because of that, there was some certificate uh-huh. called Ijazat al-Rivaya.
Yes.
It means that all people, all scholars and Hoza students were not allowed to say and write Rivaya.
Yes.
They had to get this certificate. In order, it means that they have to reach a level.
Mm-hmm.
So at that level, they were allowed to say and write Rivaya in their book. He had Ijazah to Rivaya from all three great scholars that he had.
So this Ijazah to Rivaya was different from Ijazah to Ijtihad, you mean?
Yes, that is different. Ijazah to Rivaya means that you are allowed to say that our imams said that.
This and that.
So
it needs a specific knowledge.
Yeah, specific knowledge.
Yeah, and authenticity.
But
that's right.
After the time of, after this time, I mean, when the school of Usuli appeared,
yes.
At that time, this Ijazah changed to Ijazah to Ijtihad.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Ijtihad, Rivaya is not the only source. We use from Rivaya, we use from Quran, we use from Aql, we use from Ijma. We have four sources. So Ijazatul Ijtihad is something greater than Ijazatul Rivaya. But before the time of Usulis, we didn't have anything called Ijazatul Ijtihad, only Ijazatul Rivaya. I mean, at his time, he could get that certificate, Ijazatul Rivaya, and he was able to get that from three great scholars, Sahib Riyad, Sayyid Bahlul Ulum,
yes.
And Sayyid Muhammad Mahdi Khorasani, and that is a great achievement for
That's
a
right.
scholar.
Nice point and nice differentiation between Ijazatul Ijtihad and Ijazatul Rivaya. Thank you very much, Shaykh Fadai.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah. Shaykh Rouhani, some of his achievements in India were really great. For example, establishing Salat al-Jum'ah in Lucknow and Salat al-Jama'ah in Lucknow by him leading by a Shiite one over there among his achievements. Let's explain a little bit about this.
Yes, as you know, unfortunately, the colonizers sometimes supported anti-Shiite kind of teachings, doctrines, and schools. As we mentioned in the life of Sayyid Lucknowi as well, that the Britain, let's say, queen, ordered the people yes. not to say azan in the azan ashadu the shahada of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. So you see that unfortunately these sort of problems sometimes were there for the Shiite communities.
Yes.
One of the great things that great achievement that made by this scholar, as you rightly mentioned, was the qiyam or resistance for having the Jum'ah prayer for the Shiite community. So that's why, of course, it was one of the great achievement of this Shiite scholar, because it is the Salatul Jum'ah or the Jum'ah prayer that gather Muslims, that gather Tashayyu and followers of the school Ahl al-Bayt, and strengthen and empower them.
Yes.
In terms of their culture, their, let's say, teachings, unity, and also, let's say, understanding better the school of Ahl al-Bayt, alayhim salatu wasalam. That's why, of course,
yes.
as you rightly mentioned, it was one of the great achievements mm-hmm. of this great scholar. But beside that, we see that he had lots of great works in fiqh, in kalam, theology, in usul al-fiqh, in philosophy, in logic, in history. Some of them we can mention, that Mir'at al-Uqul fi ilm al-usul, which is an usuli
yes,
book.
Yes, this is a famous book.
Right. And the other book, which is very much well-known in India, it is Tuhfa Isna'ashariya, which was written by Mawlawi Dehlawi against the Shayyo. This
yes.
book is criticized severely by this great scholar, and he wrote a response to that book, which is again very much a great achievement. Sharh Hadiqatul Muttaqeen, which is about fiqh, about taharat, sawm, zakat. The most interesting point is that most of these Indian scholars' works are published in Farsi.
Yes, yes.
In Persian language. It means that at that time, Farsi and Persian was the scientific or the scholarly language of the people.
Yes.
That's why it was published
you mean
in Farsi.
Among the Shiite scholars,
exactly,
Persian was welcomed very
this
much.
Book is Hadiqatul Muttaqin, is a very... The book that is used by the people, you know, because it is about Tahara, Sawm, Zakat, it shows that majority of the people even know this language and they were speaking with this language and they were reading their books in this language. Because it was like Risala Amaliya, like Tawdih al-Masail, which was written for the public in Farsi. That's really, really interesting. And there are some other books like Muntaha al-Afkar fi Usul al-Fiqh. They are the great works of this great scholar in supporting the Usuli school in India.
That's right. Still, the libraries of the Lucknow and the other cities in India are very much rich in terms of the manuscripts. I mean, the Shiite manuscripts and so many of the scholars from Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon travel to India in order to benefit from the library. Some of the volumes of the manuscripts are found only over there, in the Shiite libraries of India. Say Dildar Ali Naqvi, as we said, was the first, that's right, Congregational Sarat leader in the, we can say, Rajab 27th. He led the prayer, the Jum'ah prayer and Salat in Lucknow. He was the first Shiite imam of the Jum'ah prayer in Lucknow. Sheikh Fadai, any other details regarding his life?
Yes, I want to mention that one of the achievements that our scholars, Islamic scholars, like Sayyid Dildar Ali Naqvi, they had in their life is to show the real unity of Islamic society.
Yes.
You see that? How they have a connection between India, Iraq, and Iran. Just in order to gain knowledge, he went to Iraq and had some professors there. And then he went to Iran in Mashhad. He used other professors. Then got back to his country, India, and taught there. So this good relationship between three countries, just by the subject of knowledge, science of Ahlul Bayt, science of religion.
Yes.
That is the way that we can have the unity in our Islamic society.
Very good.
And then the works that he had done, like Namaz al-Jum'ah, Namaz al-Jama'ah, you know, these are, all of them are the symbols of unity of Islamic society, which is one of the duties of Islamic scholars that he did very good.
Yes, that's right. Thank you very much. Rajab 19th, 1235, he passed away in the city of Lucknow. His body was taken into Darul Taziyah Cemetery or Hosseiniya and was buried over there. Today, this cemetery is known by the name of Hosseiniya Kufran Ma'ab. We see this is a title given also to Sayyid Dildar Ali Naqvi. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstudy.ir, Call of Islam page. See another episode. God bless you. Fi
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan kullu man kana muhibban lahum kullu man kana muhibban lahum يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
An-naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-hadi means the guide. All the imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdi'a al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaa.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was a pure source of wisdom and knowledge. Despite his young age, he showed what divinely gifted knowledge really looks like. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the 10th divinely appointed imam, and he was the 10th divinely appointed successor of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the son of the 9th divinely appointed imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. After Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam answered with the answers of an expert the most difficult of questions posed to him by the Shia scholars and jurisprudents, the Shia leaders at that time had more faith and certainty now of what they had previously believed, that a divinely appointed imam must have the most knowledge, and he must be the most knowledgeable one of his time, regardless of whether he is young or old. And so the knowledge, virtue, and the delving into the sciences of the Holy Quran and the Sunnah of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam astonished the minds and sparked meetings and gatherings in all parts of the Muslim world. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Jamiatul Kabira by Imam Hadi alayhi salam, along with its English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As-salamu ala a'immat al-huda wa masabih al-tuja wa a'lam al-tuqa wa dawilluha.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thoughts, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call in the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all. ورحمة الله وبركاته السلام على محل Peace be upon the exponents of the recognition of Allah, the centers of Allah's blessing, the essence of Allah's wisdom, the keepers of Allah's secrets, the bearers of Allah's book, the successor of Allah's prophet, and the progeny of Allah's messenger. May Allah send blessings upon him and his household. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them. ورحمة الله وبركاته السلام على الأئمة الدعاة Peace be upon the Imams, the leaders, the guides, the chiefs, the authorities, the defenders, the protectors, the people of the reminder, the men in authority, the left ones by Allah, His select, His party, the case of His knowledge, His argument, His path, His light, His proof. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, this divinely appointed Imam from the household of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. So there's this very beautiful conversation that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam has with one of his companions. And it's interesting, the companion was kind of asking about various different things, and eventually we find that in responding to the companion, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, he starts to talk about these very central and universal, I guess, realities, if you will. The beauty about the divinely appointed imams is that, you know, they spoke in such a profound manner, and their words themselves were so profound, you know, and I guess it's something that's not too strange when you take into consideration the fact that they were connected with the Almighty Allah, and the Almighty Allah, of course, being the source of knowledge and wisdom. So this is, you know, it's not strange that they said such profound and immaculate words. And so we find that in this conversation, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, he says that the ways that Allah has forbidden are the ways of Iblis, the ways of Shaitan, and the promise of eternal bliss is that which is in paradise. You know, and even though this conversation continues, but even these two small statements are something which are really profound, you know. They're something that, well, one can really reflect and think upon, and it is an interesting reality of the universe and of the cosmos. This idea that, you know, the ways that Allah has forbidden are the ways of Iblis, the ways of Shaitan. And so, you know, who is Shaitan? Shaitan, of course, is this rebel who has rebelled, who has transgressed against the commandments of the Almighty Allah in a very brazen and overt manner. You know, when despite praying and worshiping Allah for thousands of years, you know, when it came to a serious test, and when it came to paying obeisance to Prophet Adam alayhi salam, we find that Shaitan openly and
and brazenly. He opposed the Almighty Allah and opposed him, you know, right in his face, metaphorically speaking. You know, it wasn't something that was very hidden or very internal. No, it was quite brazen and arrogant. So this idea that the ways of shaitan are the ways that Allah has forbidden all of us from doing, you know, and it kind of, you know, lets you understand and lets you realize that Allah does not forbid things for no reason. The reason that Allah forbids us from certain things is because they are ways which lead to humiliation and shame and down this dark path in which there is only pain and suffering involved. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Hadi, alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
In the limelight.
Since the war began in Gaza in October, approximately 2 million Palestinians have been displaced from the north to the south. Of these, an overwhelming body of research documented Palestinian civilians being bombed, shot at, executed, arrested, tortured, treated in a degrading manner, and forcibly disappeared by the Zionist regime military along roads, corridors, and zones declared safe. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Sohila was alone in her apartment when the Zionist regime began its genocidal war on October 7th. All she could hear were the sounds of explosions. All she could do was pray for the people being martyred. Before returning to Gaza a few years ago, Sohila had spent a decade in Egypt. She came back as she wanted to see her nephews and nieces. Little did she know the horrors that would await her. A 63-year-old wheelchair user, Sohila lived in Sheikh Radwan area of Gaza City. She remained there after the Zionist regime ordered everyone in northern Gaza, including Gaza City, to leave their homes during the early days of the war. The situation in Sheikh Radwan became increasingly serious, especially after the Zionist regime sent tanks into the area. Israel showed no mercy toward children or older people. The violence got closer and closer to Sohila's apartment. All she could hear were explosions, the siren sound from ambulances, people screaming. The noises were so loud and intense that she thought she would go deaf. When a lull took place, Sohila heard her door being knocked. A voice called, "Is there anyone there?" She replied, "Yes, I am here." Her voice was weak and she could not raise it. The knocking on her door continued and Sohila kept saying, I am here. She managed to get into her wheelchair. A short while later, the door burst open. A man appeared. He asked, Are you the only one in this apartment? She said, Who are you? The man explained that he was a civil defense worker. He told her that she needed to get out of the apartment quickly. The whole block, he added, was about to be targeted by the Zionist regime. Sohila was shocked and angry at the news, but suppressed her emotions. She asked the civil defense worker to help her get two thobs from her closets. And she bid a hasty farewell to her apartment. She was brought to Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. She went to stay with relatives there. Her relatives' home was not adapted for someone using a wheelchair. Sohila needed help going to the bathroom. She depended on her relatives for food and water. Sohila did not stay long in Khan Yunis. Not long after her arrival, the Zionist regime began bombarding the city, forcing a large-scale evacuation. She headed with her relatives to Rafah, further south. Unfortunately, she became separated from them amid a general commotion. Alone on Rafah's streets, Sohila had no idea what to do or where to go. A young man came to her and brought her to a mosque. Sohila took shelter in the mosque. At the mosque, Sohila became quiet, agitated. A volunteer nurse named Sama noticed that her health was worsening. When Sohila was offered food, she refused it. In her distressed state, she accused others in the mosque of trying to kill her. On one occasion, Sohila agreed to eat a little after hours of persuasion. She asked for an apple and some chocolate, but neither of those could be found. If they were still available in the markets, they were too expensive for people taking shelter to afford. Early one morning, she had a burst of energy. She requested to visit the bathroom and to change her clothes. Suddenly, she started vomiting. An ambulance came and took her away. On the way to the hospital, she died. No funeral was held. Some people may attribute her death to natural causes, or her age, or illness. But we are convinced she was tormented and died because of sorrow. She died in a strange place. She was hungry and thirsty and had nobody from her family around her.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Allah desires ease for us in the holy month of Ramadan and our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's an honor to be here. Dear friends, we are talking about how Allah the Almighty desires ease for us in the holy month of Ramadan and in our Islamic lifestyle. Now, these kind of pointers are really important because if we don't have the right perception,
if we don't have the right view, if we don't have the right understanding of the holy month of Ramadan, then what happens is that we're not able to benefit from the holy month of Ramadan because, you know, we're kind of turned off and we don't really understand the benefits, let alone try to acquire the benefits. So one of the most fundamental things, you know, that an individual needs to do is to understand the essence of the holy month of Ramadan. And, you know, of course, we can never fully understand the, you know, complete universal and cosmic depths of the holy month of Ramadan because it is so vast. But at least on a superficial level, there are very profound things about the holy month of Ramadan, you know, that we can try to understand. For example, the fact that it is a month in which we are easily able to connect with our Creator, the Almighty Allah. That in itself is such a huge thing if you start to think about it, you know. And a lot of times, the lifestyle that we live and this Western-oriented lifestyle that's been kind of forced down the throats of the people of the world is a lifestyle which prevents you from thinking. It doesn't allow you to think or contemplate. It doesn't allow you to reflect upon your life, upon your, you know, goal in living. It doesn't let you think about your future or your past or, you know, your deeds or your relationship with God. You know, it is a culture that it primarily just keeps you busy so that you're constantly in this rat race making money for somebody else.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about how Allah desires ease for us in this holy month of Ramadan. You know, we had talked about in the previous segment how if we don't have the correct perception or the correct understanding of the holy month of Ramadan, then it's going to make it difficult for us to really take advantage of this holy month. And, you know, we said that thinking is something that is good. Contemplating, reflecting is something that is good and something that is highly encouraged in Islam, and it is highly discouraged in the Western culture and in Western discourse. So in the Holy Quran, Allah Himself says in Surah Al-Baqarah, verse number 185 of chapter number 2, He says that Allah desires ease for you and He does not desire for you difficulty. And this is in respects to the holy month of Ramadan. So Allah wants ease for us. You know, if you're sick, for example, if you're traveling, if you are expecting a baby, even if you're suckling an infant, these are all situations in which an individual does not need to fast, right? So people that are not in this category, or for example, if, you know, small children as well, they kind of fall under those who are sick, or they fall under the category of those who are just not able to fast. They don't have the strength to do so, right? So when you take everybody else in, they're all strong, healthy, sane people. And so it is relatively easy for these people to fast. And, you know, we've run out of time, but if we keep this in mind that Allah wants ease for us, He does not want difficulty, does not want to put us in a difficult position. If He puts us in a test or a trial, it's because Allah knows that we have the potential to be able to succeed. When we start to think like this, then it really impacts our holy month of Ramadan, and of course it impacts and has an effect on our Islamic lifestyle.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You lift me up high, you spread my wings and fly me to the sky. I feel so alive, it's like my soul thrives in your light. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around. Ramadan.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Gaza, many healthcare facilities have been decimated by the Zionist regime's attacks or evacuated, while a few remain open but severely limited in the care and services they offer. Israeli regime forces have repeatedly laid siege to hospital facilities, killing hundreds of medical workers and kidnapping scores of others, despite thousands of internally displaced Palestinians sheltering in the healthcare complexes. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "It took 9 hours before Shahinaz Al-Attar began her dialysis session. She had left the tent where she is staying in Rafah, southern Gaza, at 8 a.m. After arriving at Abu Yusuf al-Najjar, a hospital in the city, she had to sit in an uncomfortable chair and wait. Shahinaz, 27, was uprooted from Beit Lahia in northern Gaza during the early stages of the current war. She first went to Ashifa, Gaza's largest hospital, but had to evacuate when the Zionist regime attacked. Israel's violence was so extreme that the hospital could no longer function. Following the attack on Ashifa Hospital, Shahinaz moved to a school run by the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, in the southern city of Khan Yunis. She was able to receive dialysis in Nasser Medical Complex initially. That hospital, also located in Khan Yunis, was later besieged by the Zionist regime's forces with catastrophic effects for its patients. As a result, Shahinaz is now having treatment for her kidney complaint in Rafah." Shahinaz said, "Before the war, I used to have dialysis 3 times a week. Each session would last for 4 hours. When we were displaced to Ashifa Hospital, the sessions were reduced to 3 hours. Because the health service in Gaza is under the severest strain imaginable, Shahinaz can now only have 2 dialysis sessions of 2 hours per week. Shahinaz is accompanied by her father, when she visits the hospital for dialysis. Getting there from her tent is an ordeal. It often takes an hour before they can find someone who will drive them there. On occasions, she has traveled in an overcrowded truck, a cart pulled by an animal, or in a tuk-tuk. Abu Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital has less than 20 dialysis machines. Before the current genocidal war, it treated just over 100 kidney patients. That number has risen sevenfold. The heavy demand for the dialysis machines means that patients have to endure lengthy waits before one becomes free. Most of the medicines and patients need are not available or very scarce. Shahinaz only has canned food to eat, which is totally unsuitable for kidney patients. She struggles to find clean water. She said, "I have no hope that I can stay alive. I'm very tired and I feel that if I don't die because of the bombing, I will die from illness." Middle East Monitor also wrote, "The Secretary General of Doctors Without Borders said they have been witnessing the systematic destruction of health services in the Gaza Strip since October 7, 2023. Talking to Anadolu Agency on the latest situation in Gaza under Israel's brutal bombing campaign, Christopher Lockyer said, "There is a catastrophe across Gaza. We are particularly concerned about the situation in the north of Gaza, where we have almost no access." He added that MSF is incredibly worried about what will happen if the Zionist regime launches a ground attack on Rafah in the south of Gaza, where 1.5 million people are currently taking refuge. The bombing campaign has brought with it the systematic destruction of health services in the Gaza Strip, he explained, emphasizing that medical teams have been compelled to shift between hospitals due to evacuations. Highlighting the challenging nature of treating patients with injuries that necessitates high-quality medical care, he said, "It's extremely difficult, even impossible, to provide this level of care to patients in Gaza right now." Lockyer added, "We genuinely seek access to provide treatment and support to the people in the northern region of Gaza. Aerial aid and the construction of a temporary port will not solve the situation in Gaza," adding that he was worried that the images of airdrops of aid distract from the situation on the ground and emphasizing the need for a political solution. He stated, "Healthcare workers must not endure intimidation or fear of indiscriminate bombing before they can deliver healthcare and humanitarian aid. For meaningful humanitarian assistance in Gaza, we require far more access, resources, and security." He added, "We fear that hunger is being used as a weapon of war with this blockade. Our staff members report starvation and malnutrition affecting them and their families."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 23rd, 2015, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with government officials on the occasion of the month of Ramadan. On the issue of the economy, I should say that the month of Ramadan is the month of piety. What is piety? Piety means constant care of ourselves so that we do not take the wrong path and do not get stuck in the thorns of problems. Piety is in fact an armor that a pious person wears. It protects him from the harm caused by poisonous arrows and deadly spiritual blows. Of course, this harm is not confined to spiritual matters. And for those who fear Allah, He prepares a way out. He provides for him from sources he never could imagine. The Holy Quran, chapter 66, verses 2-3. Piety has many important effects, even in worldly affairs. This is personal piety. The same thing holds true for society and a country.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
What is the piety of a country? What is the piety of a society? A society, particularly if it has lofty and elevated ideals like the Islamic Republic society, is under constant attack. It is subject to attacks launched with poisonous arrows. This requires piety as well. What is social piety? Social piety can be defined for different areas. In the area of the economy, social piety means the economy of resistance. If we want to avoid the harm caused by global fluctuations, or if we want to avoid the poisonous arrows that are fired by hostile policies in the world, we have no option other than turning to the economy of resistance. The economy of resistance is an element of strength in the face of all those people and powers that use all their economic, political, media, and security capacities in order to deliver a blow to our people, our country, and our system. One of the ways that they have found until today is penetration through economy.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh,
of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
In the Great Mosque of the Old City of Sana'a, the Yemeni Scholars Association convened a meeting calling for the nation's scholars to fulfill their role in the Al-Aqsa fluid battle and the ensuing victory. The event saw a significant turnout of Yemeni scholars.
Our message to the scholars who have shirked their responsibility to support Gaza is to fear God, for that will expose them to God's punishment in this world and the hereafter. Silence regarding what our brothers endure in Gaza amounts to participating in the Zionist enemies' crimes against children and women. The people will also justify their silence with the silence of their scholars and rulers. Therefore, their sin is greater than that of the rest of the people.
The participants criticized the inaction of Muslim scholars regarding the atrocities in Gaza, labeling it the genocidal war by Israel. They emphasized the scholars' profound responsibility, asserting their religious duty to support their Palestinian brothers. They argued that the current situation in Palestine is the consequence of decades of silence.
The responsibility of the scholars is great, as they are the ones who can move the streets and the people, and they can compel the rulers to act with the fatwa or word from them in support of Gaza.
Since the onset of the war on Gaza, Yemeni scholars have actively participated in weekly demonstrations supporting Palestine and have encouraged public demonstrations in solidarity. Furthermore, the Scholars Association has declared its support for the Yemeni military's naval operations targeting Israeli maritime activities and its allies. Yemeni scholars assert that the normalization deals between Arab countries and Israel have emboldened the regime to continue its oppressive campaign against Palestinians. They urge all Muslim scholars to advocate for Palestine, regardless of their government's possessions. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani will meet with U.S. President Joe Biden in Washington on April 15 for talks on the U.S. military presence in the Arab country. Also, a range of other issues, including the fight against Daesh and the ongoing Iraqi financial reforms, will be discussed.
The demands of Iraqi nation and political blocs will be taken to Washington by the Prime Minister. We all know there is a large consensus in the country to end the foreign forces' presence. The Prime Minister will also discuss the economic situation and challenges, most importantly, the U.S. dollar exchange rates, which have been affecting the market since the imposition of sanctions by U.S. Treasury on Iraqi banks.
In January, Baghdad and Washington began formal talks about ending the coalition mission, purportedly formed to help the Iraqi forces to fight Daesh terrorist group. After the defeat of Daesh in 2017 by Iraqi anti-terror forces, the U.S. still stationed some 2,500 troops in Iraq and 900 in neighboring Syria as a part of the coalition mission.
It's time for the government to end the coalition mission. It's the demand of the Iraqi people. We all agree that these forces have gone too far, violating our sovereignty, so today we witness the calls by the Iraqi nation that the time has come for these forces to leave.
Following the parliamentary decision in 2020, Iraqi authorities have agreed for drawing up a timeline to end the presence of foreign forces, which proved by action to be a threat to the country's stability. Iraqi nation agrees that foreign forces' presence is no longer necessary, and the Prime Minister will carry their demands to Washington. Muslim Salem, Baghdad.
Salman Qasimi, an Islamic school teacher, says it's an unprecedented move in India to ban madrasas instantly, calling it a blow to marginalized Muslim families across India's most populous state of Uttar Pradesh. He says lives of thousands of families are directly dependent on such institutions, while the government of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi accuses them of receiving illegal funding. Scholars argue such institutions are building blocks of Islamic teachings across the country, which regular schools can't do.
This judgment is unfortunate. We respect the court decision, but we oppose it. Our constitution allows us to have such schools to teach Islamic values to future generations. If this is against secularism, why it was made in the first place? Every citizen can read, write, promote or propagate their religion. That's what our constitution says. Madrasa's instant closure is a blow to livelihood of thousands of families.
In January, the government of Uttar Pradesh state halted a funding program for madrasas, leaving more than 20,000 teachers unemployed. Scholars say Friday's verdict applies to all Islamic schools in the state that are privately and government funded. In recent months, India's northeastern state of Assam converted hundreds of madrasas into conventional schools.
all the laws and all the things which are BJP is enacting or BJP is targeting the Muslim community, definitely they think that the if they want to rule the country, so they can rule the country when they can demonize Muslim community, they can suppress Muslim community, they can make them vetless at the time of election. So all these efforts are taking place because of the RSS background, RSS agenda of the present ruling party.
In recent months, Modi's government turned down new proposals from the states and halted payments to schemes that would finance Muslim schools. Critics say this amounts to snatching the livelihood of thousands of families instantly, while they have no other means of earning.
India will hold general elections in a few weeks' time, and the BJP's victory is imminent, according to observers. Activists and rights groups have accused the governing party of promoting anti-Islamic rhetoric in a deliberate attempt to appease the majority voters by polarizing the voters, therefore using divide-and-rule policy to win the elections.
Rights groups have accused the BJP government of persecuting and intimidating Muslims through all possible means. The accusation BJP rejects, saying India is a vibrant democracy enshrined in equality for all. Critics